Hello, and welcome to Tide Talk, where we bring the events in the East to the rest in the West. Today, and for the start of our second series, Dr. Mark Bletcher of Oberlin University. Dr. Bletcher is a professor of politics and East Asia studies. He received his PhD in political science from the University of Chicago and has been teaching at Oberlin since 1988. Dr. Bletcher also penned such books as China Against the Tides, Restructuring the Revolution, and China, Politics, Economics, and Society. Topping off his illustrious career are tens of articles that deal primarily with rural Chinese politics, but at the very depths of that niche. That's enough for me. How are you, Dr. Bletcher? How's this semester been for you?
Hectic, as always, and the last couple of days, kind of rocky, but still enjoying teaching a lot. I could retire at my ripe old age, but I'm having too much fun to think about something like that.
What have you been teaching recently?
Right now I'm teaching my introductory survey, which covers the Qing up to the present, although we moved pretty quickly to get to 1949 and spend about 5 weeks on the Maoist decades and then the rest of the semester on the structural reform period.
I am a big fan of survey classes, and the one China survey class I took when I was in my undergraduate was so much fun. And I really wish there was more material for it. But without further ado, let's get into the questions for today. So number one, where do you relations stand with Washington and Beijing now that there's a far more adversarial administration in the office right now?
It's more adversarial. And it could tip either way, depending on what the new administration does. It's just impossible to predict. If the administration goes for all the tariffs that they're talking about, it could get pretty ugly, both in U.S.-China relations, and also it will tank the American economy. But this is not a guy who one can predict about. So I wouldn't hazard a guess. Worse than it was, going to say, 10, 15 years ago, sadly, because it doesn't have to be this way. We could be doing the same level of trade and the same level of diplomatic relations without all this, but I think both sides have found some advantage, political advantage, in ramping up conflict and then trying to keep it under control.
What do you think the Chinese end of that is? Because the American leverage on that would be, say, economic independence like Joe Biden has been doing with decoupling. What would be the Chinese advantage?
I think they're mostly responding to the U.S., actually. I think they're not looking to pick a fight with us, but because it's not really in their interest to do so. But once we have started rattling our sabers, they have no choice but to respond. And the rattling of sabers on our end is something that's been in the political interest of both Democrats and Republicans. China provides, as it has provided for many decades during the Cold War, a convenient whipping boy. And it's sad to see that still going on because the stakes are so much higher. And as I said, the conflict's not really necessary.
Well, I guess that leads us into question two. Given Trump's statements around tariffs over last year, which we were discussing, do you think a trade war is on the horizon?
If he goes ahead with it, absolutely. China buys a lot from us, and they will definitely respond. No Chinese government, no Chinese leader could just allow the tariffs to go up without putting their own tariffs on. And it'll hurt American companies who are invested in China or who export to China, of whom there is a huge number. So it's just could get bad for a while.
What safety guards do you think are in place for that? Because I'm concerned we've reached a point politically in the U.S. where the safety rails are kind of getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And my fear is that there's nothing stopping this administration from doing something that I consider quite silly. Do you believe this would be the case?
Yes, I agree. And one of the craziest of Trump's advisors during the first term was Peter Navarro, who was positively nuts.
He advised that
the U.S. carry out a preemptive nuclear strike on China's nuclear facilities. He's the only one of Trump's guys, aside from Bannon's, who ended up going to jail. He's really a nutcase, and he made himself into something of a quote China expert unquote, although he's not. But he marketed himself that way, and he threw a lot of weight around in the Trump administration for his so-called expertise on China, which he didn't actually have. If he comes back, or there are other like-minded people like him, could get very dangerous. I often tell my students that I don't like to be an alarmist. Now you're waiting for the but, right? There are two places on the planet where a nuclear exchange might happen if it were to happen. One is in the Indian subcontinent, and the other is in the Taiwan Straits.
Taiwan? Really?
The Taiwan Straits, sure.
What a place to start nuclear holocaust.
U.S. and China are... why is that worse in particular? What do you think, Grace, that it's worse in particular than... I mean, there's no good place for it to happen, obviously, but what?
It's more of just... It's with India and Pakistan, for example, right? There is some very deep bad blood, and there is some huge political machinations at play. With Taiwan, it almost seems relatively petty, which I know is sort of a probably not the greatest way to put it, but it's a relatively small island. It comes from like a minor political, at this point, minor political disagreement between, you know, the mainland and the former republic. So it's just, of all places to be in the end of the world, I think.
I don't know how you think about, I don't know how one thinks about the scale of the interests on both sides. Taiwan is economic powerhouse in a lot of ways, if you think about semiconductors and other electronics. I should have added there are three places on the planet where it could happen. The other, increasingly, sorry to say, would be Israel-Iran. So things are getting a little scarier. I think there could be a war without a nuclear exchange, for sure. There could be. Taiwan, well, I mentioned semiconductor production in Taiwan. Taiwan's semiconductors factories in Taiwan have been rigged with explosives by the Taiwan military, so that the People's Republic won't be tempted to try to attack to get control over this very advanced site for production of semiconductors. I mean, so that's where we are. And Trump, you know, heard all this talk during the campaign about, oh, to give this guy the nuclear codes, you know. Who knows?
It's very much a keeps you awake at night reality now that we're in a post-November 5th world. Returning to the idea of the safety guards, I mean, you know, the Bannonites are out. Like all the Well, I can't even say that very comfortably because Laura Loomer was on the staff. But the really oddball reactionary right online figures seem to have been filtered out of the Trump admin in exchange for more dangerous, more experienced, but more institutional actors that are still equally as, I'd say, reactionary, but maybe not as tactless about it. And I think that could provide the slightest bit of safety rail, but it's too early to tell, in my opinion.
Let's hope you're right. We'll have to wait and see who takes over the China desk at the National Security Council to know. The saner voices within the State Department probably will be pushed aside because the administration will centralize all this stuff within the White House itself. So
it's a really interesting time we live in, huh?
That's what they like to say in China. We live in interesting times.
Hello, it's Grayson Post, and I wanted to expand upon the comments about Taiwan being a flashpoint for conflict. Something I wanted to say, but didn't get around to, was mentioned by Mark in a conversation around semiconductors. Since the earliest days of the Biden admin, the creation of a native semiconductor industry has been a large place of investment for the United States. Although the incoming Trump administration has yet to comment their thoughts about this policy, we can safely assume that this is one of the few Biden-era investments that will carry over. Given this, Taiwan might fall in relevancy to its greatest offender. What I said about Taiwan was a bit heavy-handed, but this is what I meant. Taiwan is worthy of defense and represents a unique culture separate from its mainland sibling. That being said, defense by the United States is hinged on strategic importance, not principle. Rounding off this addendum, I leave you with this. If the U.S. stops going to Taiwan for trade, and our relationship becomes purely for military purposes, is the region any more or less dangerous? Anyways, back to the interview. Moving on to question 3. What is the Chinese reaction to this election outcome that you know of? Does the Chinese business community and government see eye to eye on a post-Biden plan, or is there any internal tension on this issue?
There's a kind of complex complex matrix of opinion on both sides. Your question, you mentioned the business community. Well, the business community is complicated. Some Chinese firms are international, more international, and some are more oriented to the domestic economy. Government is a highly complex set of institutions in China, and some will be, they haven't said anything publicly, but some will be wishing for Trump to come in because, for Trump to have won, because they think his isolationism will help them. Others just think the chaos that will flow will be too dangerous. So there's a big concatenation of opinions, pro and con, that we're wishing for Trump's election and wishing for Harris's election on both sides. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, kind of like the American State Department, was probably much more full of people who were wishing the Democrats would win because then foreign policy would be conducted by people like them through normal channels that they understand. Whereas with Trump being in, you have to deal directly with the White House, and there's unpredictability there. So they were all over the map. They probably still are. And I doubt there's anybody on the Trump side who has any good idea what they're talking about. Whereas how to think about the China problem. They just don't know it, and they're not systematic thinkers enough to really approach this in a thoughtful way. Whereas the stuff I've read from the China side, this complex set of interests that I was talking about, is extremely thoughtful. The ways in which different people and different actors in China have put their arguments for, well, Trump would be good for this, but bad for that, and Harris would be good for this and bad for that. Very thoughtful. Really have, very smart, and Many of them just come down in the middle, or some make their argument. When they make their arguments, they know what they're talking about. They understand us better than we understand them, I guess, is the short version of what I'm saying.
The way that the Chinese state like builds itself, and they very uniquely integrate, you know, functionally private sector, but in reality, it's very public in terms of investment. They integrate the business community in a way where, you know, they organize them so they can adjudicate their five-year plans and all that stuff. Do these businesses that work directly more with the Chinese state, have they expressed any more interest in having a Kamala outcome versus a Trump outcome because of the alignment with state interest?
China businesses. I don't know. I think those are conversations that they are very careful to keep quiet, to keep just between the actors themselves. So they wouldn't want to go public. I mean, politics in China is conducted in a thoughtful and quiet and careful way. So they wouldn't say. I haven't seen anything.
Could you expand on that with how politics is conducted in China?
Sure. I mean, they don't send up trial balloons in the press or make public statements. You know, you're asking, you know, businesses thinking this way or that way in there and advocating this or that in relation to the foreign ministry or other bodies in the Chinese state. And all I mean is that when they have those conversations, they're going to do them very carefully behind closed doors so as not to be seen to put excessive pressure on the other side in terms of going public. I mean, you know, very little of these kind of political issues are aired publicly in China. And because people who engage in this kind of lobbying, and there's plenty of lobbying in China between businesses and the government, to be sure, but they always want to protect their flank so in case things change, they can shift their positions. So I'm not sure anybody in the West would know that. And if they told you they did, I'd be suspicious. What's been going on in China in the last 5-7 years is sad to me, because Western business people, academics, people like me, but also Chinese Americans who are working in this country have been saying for years now that even their friends of very long standing with whom they used to be able to have frank conversations up until, I'm going to say, 7-8 years ago, now their friends in China just won't talk to them and about anything significant. And it's not because they don't want to, it's because they are afraid to. They just feel constrained. So basically, the feel that we as Americans working on China or working in China, whether you're in business, whether you're in government, whether you're in academics, the feel that we have for what's going on, our ability to take the pulse of what's happening within the Chinese state is way, way, way down. And that's not good for anybody. It's not good for U.S.-China relations. It's not good for the state of what we know about China. And it hasn't changed much since COVID was finally brought to an end and Westerners have finally been able to travel back there. I haven't had a chance to go back to China since that time, but I've talked to many of my colleagues and friends who have, and so, did you learn anything? Are your friends able to talk to you? And they say, no, what I could find out is just much too impressionistic. And So we lost that ability to get a textured sense of what's going on inside, and it's not back yet.
You said 7 to 8 years, which is a very convenient time because that is the date of the last Trump administration. Are those at all aligned, or is it coincidental?
No, I think I was talking about, where are we now, 2024. I was talking about when a time period in which when Xi Jinping finally got his legs under the table and maybe toward the end of his first term. So that's now, 2012, that would have been about 2017. So yeah, 7 to 8 years. And the strictures on academic research, on academics, on exchange of information in general, and just the regulation of the flow of information ramped up. So that's what I meant by 7 or 8 years. I don't think that had anything to do with what we're doing. Most Americans think that the U.S. has more influence on what goes on inside China than we actually do. I think they march to their own drummer. And while it's true that if we ramp up conflict with them, it will affect what's going on within the state. But it's not that the ebb and flow of what goes on in the government is driven by what they think about us or but it would be driven by problems we are creating with them.
For question 4, which asks, what are your personal thoughts on the election relative to your field of study? Do you have any hopes or fears for the next 4 years? Dr. Blecher provided a pre-written statement that he'd like me to share. Quote, the stupor many Americans are feeling provides the crucial, clarifying starting point. We've all been fumbling around in the dark. All the pollsters, pundits, podcasters, politicians, and publishers, wrong. All the candidates, campaign staffs, and volunteers, including me, confused. The $14 billion price tag, wasted. The Democrats executed perfectly. It didn't matter. Our failure to take sufficient accounts on racism, sexism, or class, a repeated mantra of the Wednesday morning quarterbacks. Do come into it, but not the way we think. Something much deeper is going on. It's not new, and it's right before our eyes if only we will see it. And shockingly, it's as American as apple pie. 70 years ago, the great American historian Richard Hofstadter published The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Many scholars and educated citizens read it long ago in grad school, but then forgot it. Tuesday night, through my tears, I reread it. The distinguishing thing about the paranoid style is not that its exponents see conspiracies or plots here and there in history, but they regard a vast or gigantic conspiracy as a main force in historical events. History is a conspiracy, set in motion by demonic forces of almost transcendent power. And what is felt to be needed to defeat it is not the usual methods of political give and take, but an all-out crusade. The paranoid spokesman sees the fate of this conspiracy in apocalyptic terms. He traffics in the birth and death of whole worlds, whole political orders, whole systems of human values. He is always manning the barricades of civilization. He constantly lives at a turning point. It is now or never in organizing resistance to conspiracy. Time is forever just running out. Like religious millenarians, he expresses the anxiety of those who are living through the last of days, and he is sometimes disposed to set a date for the apocalypse. Hofstadter showed that this has been present in American politics from the beginning. The anti-Masonic movement in the 1790s, recurrent anti-Catholicism starting with the Puritans, the World War II internment of the Japanese Fifth Column, the drumbeat of anti-Semitism against the secret machinations of Jews, McCarthyism, the long-standing panic over vaccines and fluoridation, and many more over the centuries. He argued that the paranoid style has simmered on the back burner of our politics throughout our history. When conditions have proven sultry, it has burst into the center stage over and over, for the first time taking advantage of a leader who is truly charismatic in the religious sense of that term, a miracle maker. Modern communications technology, billionaire money to deploy it, and hateful tropes through which to express it, the paranoid style has now moved on from the margins to the White House, so many other sites of American political power, and even the capillaries of civil society. And Hofstadter is careful to say that it operates around the world, not just here. Because of its profound roots and evident longevity, it's not just another challenge to be overcome. It's more like the weather. It's always been with us and will continue to be. It's a core part of who we are. It's not all we are by any means, but to repeat, it's as American as apple pie. Whatever we do from here, we need to be clear-eyed about this. We need to stop blaming this or that Democratic politician or strategist for this debacle. We did not just fail to find or calibrate the right message, knock on enough doors, or make enough phone calls, write enough letters, or give enough money. If anything, the bizarre scale of the political campaign and our utter preoccupation with it are a large part of the problem, since it provided the stage, spotlight, and fuel for the latest emanation of the paranoid style to materialize. As my colleague Stephen Crowley wrote in 2016, our response must be strategic, not just reflexive or reactive, but we must first be brave in recognizing fully what we're up against and most likely will always be. We must take into account the power of the paranoid style in our politics and figure out how to neutralize it. There's plenty of good thinking out there, beyond Washington and the Democratic Party, about the elements of such a strategy, but it will all fail again if we don't look ourselves straight in the eye and begin with a good, hard reorientation of how we think and talk about our politics and, indeed, our country itself. Mark Butcher, Oberlin, Ohio, November 7th, 2024. And for our final question, Taiwan. In all honesty, I am unsure how the Trump admin will handle Taiwan and the delicate diplomacy it requires. What can you say about this topic? Where does Taiwan rest with Trump in the White House?
For Taiwan or for Trump's relations with Taiwan?
I think both.
Both. Well, I'm feeling a little less worried about the DPP doing something untoward. I think they've been in power a number of times, and they've become experienced politicians. And I'm less worried that they would do something rash, like just make a declaration of independence, which would cause catastrophic problems. And the reason is, one, they have matured as a party and been in power for a long time. And two, the current vice president was my student.
No, really? I just got done reading about the PP, and I actually want to interrogate you about this a little bit after we're done with this question, then, because she is fascinating.
Yeah, she's a really interesting person, B. Kim Xiao. She was my student. I'm not sure where she was brought up, but she's very American in her experience. She's got a lot of experience in the U.S., both as a student, and then she was, her latest position was Taiwan's de facto ambassador in Washington. And so she's a smart person, a very smart person, but also not somebody who's going to take a lot of risks. She has a realistic understanding of international relations and a very worldly and sophisticated person. And she's only the VP, but I think that the president is got a similar, I would describe him in similar terms, and she will have some influence with him. So that's a small reason for me to have, to be able to sleep slightly better at night thinking of about the DPP and the current government.
Now, regarding Trump in Taiwan, what do you think that looks like with like a very measured administration versus Trump's kind of chaotic form of governance?
No idea. What I was saying sooner, it all depends who gets control of that portfolio in the State Department, but especially the National Security Council. We don't know who those people are. We won't know for a little while. I don't have high expectations that any of them will be very different from somebody like Peter Navarro. This is our problem now, is that all kinds of unpredictability has been injected into the way we will be doing everything. So I don't think I have anything really to add, and I'd be suspicious if anybody did, unless they had some insider knowledge from the Trump administration or the Heritage Foundation. I don't actually know who is, if the Heritage Foundation has anybody who's a specialist who knows anything about China. I don't know that, but I don't. That would be a place to start, certainly, because they've written Project 2025, right? So we'll have to, look at that.
Before we call it quits today, is there any message you'd like to give, any work you'd like to recommend, or plug any of your own work?
Well, I'm not going to plug my own work. What could I recommend? For people interested in China, I will plug the work of one of my students who did... went out and worked in kind of an American labor-oriented NGO in Washington for many years, kind of a human rights and labor rights outfit in Washington, and then decided to go to graduate school, went to Cornell, and finished, and now holds down an academic job at University of British Columbia in Canada. It's called Workers and Change in China. His name is Manfred Elfstrom, and he asks the key question that we always ask when we were teaching our students and doing our own work, which is, so what? Does it make any difference? Because to the kind of workers' protests that are going on all the time in China, there are always workers striking, protesting, doing this and that in every city in China, big city, almost every day. And the question is, does it matter? And Manfred answers it. And his answer is, it depends, sort of. But it's a great book. And especially the cover, because Manfred is also an amateur oil painter, and he painted a beautiful image of a Chinese factory at night for the cover. So that's my recommendation.
Well, thank you for your time, and I really appreciate you answering the questions that a lot of people are going to be asking in the next few days.